And Richard Aitken is one of our finest garden historians and curators. He's written a new book called Planting Dreams, Shaping Australian Gardens, that chronicles the history of gardens in this country. There's also an exhibition of the same name on at the State Library of New South Wales. And to put it together, he selected 150 rare, beautiful and quirky objects spanning hundreds of years, because that was the way to best show the ideas and influences that shaped the way we imagine what might make a peculiarly Australian garden. Thank you for joining us, Richard.
Oh, thanks, Michael. It's great to talk gardens with you.
Now, why did you go with the title Planting Dreams? What's dreamlike about these gardens?
Well, I guess the idea was really to bring gardens back to the idea of being a personal creation, not something that's created really from the top down. I wanted to stress that idea of the human mind as an individual receptor, so that really anybody can create a garden and no two gardens are alike. We might follow some fashions or styles, but really it's a kind of very human-centred activity.
But there's an extent to which that human-centred is not just individualistic. A garden reflects, especially at points in time, the society in which it belongs. Do you think it's a fair description?
Oh, absolutely. And that's really, I guess, the central thrust of both the book and the show, is to really play those personal dreams off against what was happening in contemporary culture and society.
How does that particularly play out in a colonial context? I mean, if we think back of the history of Australia, the building of early gardens was as much about keeping a natural world that was not very European at bay.
Yes, I mean, the earliest gardens were probably really utilitarian ones. I mean, we had a simple need to grow food. The fact that people had existed here for generations before, of course, was quite alien to the European colonists. But certainly the move from that utilitarian phase to adopting international, I guess, global trends in gardening soon arose, particularly in the 1830s and 40s, when we suddenly had a middle class who had the wealth and the leisure to garden.
There's some really lovely examples in your book of kind of people in the late 19th century adopting European trends, but then finding the ways in which they had to kind of hybridise for the new environment. Tell me a bit about that evolution.
Well, probably the best example would be the fashion for subtropical gardening. A lot of northern Australia is in the subtropics, and we're very close to, say, the Pacific Islands, which are mostly also subtropical. So even though there was a fashion for these very bold-leaved plants, bold colours in European gardens, they're very much a kind of a summer garden over there and had to be taken inside during harsh winters. But here we could, by and large, grow these plants all year round, and we had access to them. So they were kind of, we had access to the plants as the basis of the gardens, and we had this kind of hybridised version of international ideas at play.
And so that kind of subtropical approach to gardening was very much at odds to the earlier cottage garden approach.
Yes, I mean, it was a reaction against it. There was a kind of a revulsion, I guess, that started perhaps with the 1851 exhibition about the kind of degradation of art, and the fact that, you know, just planting flowers, particularly in regimented order, was very mechanical. And so people like William Robinson, who was a journalist who had covered, say, the big exhibition in Paris in 1867, was able to report on trends there, which then went kind of viral in 21st century terms, and a lot of Australian newspapers picked up these reports. Our horticultural magazines reprinted this material, and Robinson was really, I guess, arguing for kind of whole of plant approach to value boldness of foliage, boldness of form, colour, and not just to rely on the individual flower.
The phrase that crops up in your book is that the 19th century was a time for the battle of the styles in Australian gardens. The good thing about gardeners going into battle is they've got good implements, I think, when they're going against each other.
Yes, I guess the whole mechanical side of gardening is fascinating, and really in the 19th century it was largely a product of people's own hands and their own volition. Really, mechanisation didn't come into gardening, you know, till much later in the 20th century. So I guess if you only had a shovel and a rake, you could manage a modest garden. Of course, if you had a large villa garden or a mansion, you know, you could employ a small army of people.
Well, there is definitely something in there about class and about who was able to really create these extraordinary gardens. But the other kind of inflection point that you write about in the book is the First World War and the way in which the young men leaving to fight really changed the face of garden design in Australia. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, of course, there was a very high proportion of young males went to the First World War, and of course, a very large proportion of them didn't come back or came back, you know, as very different people. And so that really created a kind of opening for women and a kind of enforced gender preferment, I suppose. So it paved the way for designers like Edna Walling in Melbourne, Elsie Cornish in Adelaide, Jocelyn Brown in Sydney, to not only take on professional garden designs, which had by and large been the province of men, but also to write for the growing number of garden and homemaking magazines. So things like Australian Home Beautiful started in the 1920s, and both Walling and her Melbourne colleague Olive Mellor were contributing to that with garden designs. Walling slightly more upmarket, Mellor a little bit more downmarket. But Walling in particular was fascinating because she had a really very spiky style. She almost, you know, kind of teased her readers with what she was writing about. But that, I guess, was falling on pretty responsive ears because there had been things that were trialled, say, before the war, like garden suburbs, really took off in the interwar period. And we have to remember that even despite the appalling loss of life in the war years were relatively prosperous runs economically, and that really, that prosperity continued until the 1929 Depression. So, you know, in a way, the 1920s were a period of great activity, not only in gardening, but in homemaking more generally.
When did we finally embrace native plants rather than trying to recreate English gardens?
Well, I guess there have been waves of enthusiasm. I mean, some of the very earliest gardens in the very earliest colonial times were almost subtractive gardens where people kind of just selectively cleared and might have left some shrubs and trees, or people like Mrs. MacArthur might have admired the native flowers. And so each generation really had its own take on Australian plants. At the turn of the century, people became very enamoured of wattles. In New South Wales, there was a fetish for waratahs. But by and large, people were still going out and looking and perhaps, you know, stealing them from the bush. It probably wasn't until the nurseries really came on board in the 1940s and 50s that Australian plants became more available. And then really, I guess, in the 60s, when we had the sort of bush garden movement, and one of the key figures I talk about there is Jean Walker, who with her sister Betty Maloney had a design consultancy, but also published a wildly successful little book in 1966 called Designing Australian Bush Gardens. And this really promoted a style that, I suppose, built on the landscape characteristics of Sydney. So it's probably hard to say that there was ever an Australian garden style because it's such a large continent.
And yet you still make a case through the book, I think, that there are some distinctive characteristics of the Australian garden. Before I let you go, I just want to know about kind of some of those classic historical gardens that are still around today that listeners, if they want to go and see them, could kind of get amongst. What are the ones?
Well, probably the peerless example of a 19th century garden would be the National Trust property Rip and Lee in Melbourne. Next to the ABC studios, conveniently. We shouldn't forget the ABC nearly compulsorily acquired the garden. probably some of the botanic gardens, apart from the fact that they're scientific institutions in their own right, have many historic characteristics. And then there are some modern, I guess, modernist gardens, things like Everglades out at Lura in the Blue Mountains, which is another National Trust property, is a terrific example of that kind of modernism injected into gardens. And you could, I guess, end with, there's a really interesting pairing in Sydney of Barangaroo, which is a very new garden, which is probably destined to be an historic garden. And then just across the harbour is Wendy Whiteley's so-called secret garden, not so secret when I visited it
recently. It's good that they're the worst kept secrets out there, and you've helped do your bit to keep them badly kept. No, that doesn't quite make sense, but thank you so much for joining us today.
It's great to talk, Michael.
Richard Aitken's book is called Planting Dreams, Shaping Australian Gardens. There's also an exhibition, including 150 images from the book, on display at the State Library of New South Wales. That's on until January 15th next year.
Discover the best of RN on Facebook. Simply search for ABC RN.